Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Thank you, everyone. So I'm Kai, and I'm from the University of Wollongong. And today, I'll be demonstrating the benefits of utilizing electronic word-of-mouth communication to understand cinema audiences' opinions. This presentation will be examining data from the Chinese social networking site Douban to understand Chinese audiences' opinions on the highest-grossing Hong Kong Chinese co-production, The Mermaid. So when I was writing this paper, I was really interested in this case study because it was the all-time highest-grossing film in China, but it was recently knocked down by Wolf Warrior 2, so I had to change the significance. Overall, this presentation will examine the factors behind the film's box office success through social media comments, moving away from the traditional method of utilizing surveys, focus groups, and statistical data such as box office revenues. So before we examine the case study, I'll explain the idea of the audience and the importance of examining audiences' reception. So in mass communication, the term audience refers to the receiver of an act of communication. Audiences are important for the success of a product or service, as without them, the product or service would be unknown. However, the term has accrued a more complex set of meanings due to it being the subject of alternative and opposing theoretical formulation, as audiences are based on social interactions. So Stuart Hall believes in the importance of not only exploring the text, but also to understand the audience, also known as receivers, and authors of the text, also known as senders. According to Hall, authors need to acquire a framework of audience knowledge to produce content. The idea here is that audiences are likely to comprehend a given text in the way the author intends if they share and or understand a similar cultural background. So the term audience first appeared in the 14th century and was used in the context of a hearing, such as giving an audience, which eventually expanded to also imply an assembly of listeners. However, the practice of gathering to watch a performance probably exists as long as civilization. So in ancient history, storytelling and theater performances encouraged people to congregate and view the same performance at a specific time and place, allowing them to share the same emotional learning experience. Now, the idea of the audience as we know today emerged following the advent of the printed book in the 15th century. Books allow individuals to choose mass-produced texts based on their own discretion, reflecting their own personal preference for enlightenment or entertainment. So this specific research examines the idea of the active audience, which comprises of different groups of audiences who actively consume media texts, including television and film content. Historically, in the area of social science and cultural studies, understanding audiences before and during the post-war period were based on the power of text, which focuses on how media affects audiences. A study was conducted in 1948 to understand how much influence texts hold by studying the decision-making process of voters during America's 1940s presidential election. Their study showed that influences were not only from media persuasion, but also through individuals. So further study was conducted, and it demonstrated limited evidence on the effects of media persuasion in behavior change. Instead, the study illustrated that the influence of individuals in the audience's personal environment. So according to this concept, audiences understand and appreciate text based on various demographic factors, cultural influences, and ultimately audience taste. Because of this, there will be a complexity in providing a comprehensive understanding of the mass audience. According to Bourdieu, taste is not a universal concept, but based on active cultural practices, they are constantly producing and reproducing social systems and hierarchies, creating cultural capital. Following this concept, audiences are able to decode the material produced by the author, which in this case study would be the director, from their own perspective and also within a comparable structured experience. Hence, the text, in this case the film, is seen to be entirely open to the receiver, in this case the audience, allowing the receiver to construct their own meaning. So understanding audiences allow researchers to define audiences' habits, tastes, and personality, which would enable the industry to target specific segments strategically. Comprehending audiences' opinions also allow researchers to evaluate the success of implemented strategies. Traditional methods of evaluation to understand audiences' behavior include, but are not restricted to, quantitative and qualitative surveys, focus groups, the analysis of audiences' comments, ratings, and statistical data such as box office revenues. However, with the rapid growth of digital technology, collecting data on audience behaviors has eased the process through electronic word-of-mouth communication, which can be collected and analyzed from social networking sites such as Twitter. So what is word-of-mouth communication? Word-of-mouth communication is a communication shared by target audience members about a particular product or service. Simply put, word-of-mouth communication is what audiences are saying to each other during face-to-face interaction. So the idea of word-of-mouth existed for centuries as long as there was a mass congregation of audiences watching the same performance. For example, in ancient Greek theater, audiences expressed their opinions during a performance and sometimes even jeered at actors on stage, creating word-of-mouth communication. Looking specifically at the concept of cinema, mass audiences are a feature of public film screenings where large numbers of people have the ability to view the same performance and share a similar emotional experience. From the early days of cinema, viewers have limited interaction with the on-screen object, whereas the interaction between audience members is unrestricted, giving rise to word-of-mouth communication. So word-of-mouth data can provide valuable insights into understanding audiences' opinions, as audiences believe they are recommending and giving advice to their peers without the involvement of the organization responsible for marketing the product or service in question. Word-of-mouth conversations are also seen to offer relatively objective insights, as the level of response bias will presumably be lowered compared to surveys, as they are perceived as spontaneous responses. The popularization of social networking sites created new pathways for researchers to gain deeper awareness into their target audience through the analysis of their social networking activities, also known as user-generated content. Social networking sites reduces the complexity of collecting offline word-of-mouth data and provides a great platform for collecting large amount of data from user-generated content. Presently, majority of the scholarship relating to cinema and e-word-of-mouth data focuses on the technology behind the collection of the data. Building on these studies, overall, my thesis seeks to fill the gap of audience research by analyzing the implications of international collaborations through understanding the opinions of Chinese cinema audiences through electronic word-of-mouth. This presentation focuses on a part of my thesis examining the relationship between China and Hong Kong through the official co-production, The Mermaid. Before introducing the case study, I'll briefly go through the concepts of co-productions. So international co-productions first gained popularity in Europe during the post-World War II period in the 1960s to boost the growth of European cinema through the sharing of skills and financing. Since then, co-productions have been utilized by national film industries to compete in their domestic and global markets against Hollywood and other dominant productions. Official co-productions are based on formal agreements between governments through a treaty or memorandum of understanding. In order to gain co-production status, films are required to follow a long and complicated process of meeting regulations and seeking approval from government agencies of all participating nations. To gain official approval, producers need to fulfill guidelines presented in the treaty and keep within local censorship and distribution regulations. Typically, one party is allowed a maximum of 80% of the film's financial contribution and creative control. This means if a participating country, which is based on who collects the funds, contributes to 80% of the film's finance, they have 80% control of the creatives. This means roughly 80% of the film's main cast and crew will have to be a citizen or permanent resident of that country. So once a co-production has been approved, it is considered a domestic film in all participating countries, allowing the production to be viewed as local content. This grants the approved co-production a range of benefits reserved for domestic productions, including government subsidies and priority in distribution. Examining the Canadian and European co-production relationship, which is one of the longest in the world, Colin Hoskins, Stuart McFadden, and Adam Finn conducted a survey to identify the advantages and disadvantages of co-producing with international partners. The survey results show three chief benefits, which are in line with what co-production treaties are designed to achieve. However, several disadvantages were illustrated in the study, which is mainly due to workflow processes. Disadvantages include the increasing cost and duration in the production process due to different management styles, along with the additional levels of bureaucracy filmmakers have to contend with. An additional study in 1998 also shows the effects of cultural differences in communication, which may cause misunderstanding between cast, crew, investors, and government bodies, leading to the failure or complication of obtaining official co-production status. So an example is the Australian film Mao's Last Dancer, which was only completed because it failed to gain official status from China. The film was initially planned to be an official co-production, but finished as a shot on location in China. According to the film's director, Bruce Beresford, the Chinese government wanted to censor the script and for the film to demonstrate how China is now very modern. The producers decided to ignore the directions from the Chinese, which means that the film failed to pass official requirements and also failed to secure a release date in China. Majority of the scholarship on co-productions, especially co-productions between China, primarily examines the financial benefits and drawbacks, along with the producer's role and impacts it has on the national film industries, rather than understanding the effects it has on audiences, which this research seeks to fill. China's active role in seeking international collaboration has sparked enthusiasm from foreign filmmakers. Approved collaborations provide an alternative avenue for filmmakers to screen their films in China while bypassing the restrictions in China on foreign films. According to Michael Keane, this strategy is to shift China's reputation from made in China to create in China. The government body, known as the State Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film, and Television, charged a subsidiary of the state-run China Film Group Corporation, known as the China Film Co-Production Corporation, to oversee and manage off Chinese foreign co-productions. Co-productions did exist before the Cultural Revolution, but was halted during Mao Zedong's implementation of the Great Leap Forward in 1958. Co-productions were re-established in 1979 when Deng Xiaoping came into power and announced the Open Door Policy. In 1979, the China Film Co-Production Corporation was established and appointed as the official department responsible for managing co-productions, which allows the government control over approvals and revenue streams. Initially, co-productions were used to enhance propaganda films, such as with the Italian co-production, The Last Emperor. However, when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, Chinese foreign co-productions began to flourish as reforms were implemented to create more accessible policies for foreign partners. The largest co-production partners with China are Hong Kong and Taiwan. Both Hong Kong and Taiwan have contributed and co-produced more than 50% of the total Chinese films released. To date, the Chinese government has signed 14 co-production treaties, including with Australia and New Zealand, but they mainly follow its co-production system, unlike the ones that I mentioned earlier. So basically, because China is such a powerhouse in the co-production industry, that they have set their own rules and regulations and bypassed some treaty procedures. So co-productions in China are able to select three categories, where the final approval process is dependent on the competent authority. The first is joint productions, which is provided to film produced by a China-based and foreign producer with joint investment. Second is assisted production, which involves a foreign film financed overseas with production in China. And lastly, entrusted film, which is when a foreign film entrusts a Chinese party to produce the film with accordance to specific content and technical requirements. So the presentation today is focusing on joint productions where producers are eligible to apply for domestic film status regardless of whether a treaty was signed. Films awarded with joint production status are able to avoid restrictions placed on foreign films and receive a higher percentage of revenue sharing as joint productions are treated as domestic products. This presentation today focuses on the Hong Kong film industry has had a long working co-production relationship with China, which began in the 1980s. Unfortunately, in the mid-1990s, the Hong Kong film industry started taking a dip. According to previous studies, this led to three major consequences, including the reduction of budgets, speculation of the industry's climate after the handover, and hyperproduction, which led to the loss of affection from their key industry audiences. China also treated Hong Kong film as foreign content, which meant that Hong Kong had to compete with other international productions to be included in the foreign quota implemented by the Chinese government. This not only greatly affected film content, but job availability as well. In an attempt to revive Hong Kong's economy, including the film industry, Hong Kong signed the Mainland and Hong Kong Closer Economic Partnership Agreement in 2003. This allows Hong Kong and Chinese co-productions to automatically be seen as local Chinese films, allowing Hong Kong films to expand their reach into China. The CPA also allows Hong Kong films to screen in its original Cantonese version in the Guangdong province, although the Chinese government strongly encourages the utilization of Mandarin in all its media products. The government also currently allows approved Cantonese dialogue with Chinese subtitles to be distributed in the mainland. Unlike other co-production treaties, the Hong Kong-Chinese agreement does not hold any restrictions in the film financing or creative contribution. Only one-third of the leading actors in each co-productions have to be from the mainland. However, on paper, the film's narrative and leading character must somehow relate back to China. Unfortunately, Hong Kong and Chinese co-productions are presently more dominant in the Hong Kong film industry than full Hong Kong productions. Academics and Hong Kong filmmakers have argued that the cultural identity of Hong Kong films have shifted as it moves towards creative content that falls within the Chinese government's guidelines. several independent Hong Kong filmmakers are protesting against the growing nature of such collaboration, which is also due to their personal opinions about the partnership. An example of such protests will be the full Hong Kong production 10 Years. 10 Years is a fictional feature film comprising of 5 short stories by 5 Hong Kong directors, illustrating a dystopian future of Hong Kong under the Communist Party rule. Now show a short clip of the film.
十幾年前啦，佢哋嚟到係要學廣東話噶嘛。
So this film actually won a lot of awards at the Hong Kong Film Awards, but they were not mentioned in all Chinese publication because they didn't gain approval from the Chinese government. So it was only screened in Hong Kong and other festivals around the world. So nonetheless, Hong Kong Chinese co-productions have been doing well in mainland's box office, where 7 Chinese films out of the top 10 highest grossing film of all time in China are Hong Kong Chinese co-productions. The films include Monster Hunt, Journey to the West, The Demon Strikes Back, and this presentation case study, The Mermaid. So The Mermaid is directed by Hong Kong actor and director Stephen Chow, and is a significant case study as it confirms Chow's ambition to direct and produce films for mainland audiences. Similar to his previous film, Journey to the West, Conquering the Demons, the film's dialogue is fully in Mandarin, whereas previous co-productions by Chow were filmed with a mix of Cantonese and Mandarin, which was dependent on the actor's origins and comfort of language. The film's dialogue was then dubbed in Mandarin for release in mainland and selected countries with a large Chinese diaspora, such as Singapore. The Mermaid also did not feature any Hong Kong actors in its main cast, moving away from Chow's regular Hong Kong cast, which clearly shows a shift in strategy. The film stars Chinese actors Deng Chao, Lin Yun, Zhang Yuqi, and Taiwanese singer and actor Shou Luo. Surprisingly, the film managed to bypass several censorship restrictions, including a string of sexual innuendos presented throughout the film. And also the revealing outfits worn by Zhang Yuqi. This is an issue because prior to the film release, Chinese actress and producer Fan Bingbing television drama The Empress of China was taken off air for a re-edit due to the cleavage revealing dresses worn by the character, which was actually done in reflection of the Wu era. The discrepancy in the decisions made by the State Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film and Television demonstrates the fluidity in the nation's media regulation. The film also highlights sensitive topics in China, including the nation's pollution problem, along with the behavior and attitude of the rich and powerful Chinese businessmen, also known as Fu Hao. A reason behind this could be because of Chow's participation as a member of the Guangdong Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference Committee, all their titles are very long, which is a political advisory body of China's governing system. This could also explain Chow's eagerness to assimilate his film for the Chinese market. This perhaps shows the power of Guanxi in China and the flexibility of co-producing regulations. The paper assumes here that Chow's influence in the Chinese government may have a role in the approval of the film, which may have not been approved otherwise, which audiences also notice, which we'll see later on. So this research seeks to explore these issues by focusing on the opinions on the film's mainland Chinese audiences, from the film's mainland Chinese audiences, by examining the comments they post on the Chinese social networking site Douban. First, I'll show the trailer of The Mermaid before talking more about Douban and its significance. So as with all social interactions, not all users interact in the same way on social networking sites, as communication practices differ based on various cultural indicators. As this research focuses on examining Chinese cinema audiences' opinions, we need to understand the significance of social networking among Chinese netizens. So social networking sites are seen as significant communication tool and platform for Chinese citizens to communicate and express their opinions. The number of internet users in China has steadily increased over the past decade, with over 731 million internet users by the end of 2016, which doubled the number of users in 2009. Among all Chinese internet users, 77% are active on social networking sites, which illustrates the wealth of information available online. Technological affordance has allowed Chinese young adults to blend both offline and online communication elements. According to the China Internet Networking Information Center, in 2016, Chinese users between the age of 20 to 29 constitutes the largest proportion of internet users, while 30 to 39 fell in second place. Douban, which is the data source for this research, was launched in 2005 as a platform that allows users to interact, review, and post recommendations on books, music, and film, together with the ability to create their own communities based on their personal interests. Non-registered users are able to access up to 80% of the site content, while registered users have the ability to interact with each other. So Douban is basically a combination of Twitter and IMDb, Amazon, and Spotify. So in 2017, 13.6% of all internet users in China are active on Douban, a rise from 11.15% in 2015. The site's primary audience are known as Wen Yi Qingnian, which consists of white-collar workers, along with Chinese university students who are interested in a wide range of cultural products. These users are generally considered to be more critical than the mass audience in China, given their heightened exposure to cultural globalization and its effects. It is important to note that this research is not a representation of the mass audience, but a subgroup in line with Douban's primary audiences. On their Douban profile, users are able to categorize films into watch and would like to watch, allowing users to interact and have conversations around the film's preference. Individual film pages also allow users to interact with each other based on three sections. First, short commentary. Second, questions, where they can ask questions about the film. And third, a more critical film review. The research focuses on the short commentary section. In this section, users can rate a film on a 5-point Likert type scale, where 1 star represents less satisfied and 5 stars being the most satisfied. Users can also leave a comment of a maximum of 140 characters. Other users are able to interact with this comment by rating its usefulness and replying to the comment. The analysis consists of both the short commentary text and the rating tag to the comment and film, utilizing both qualitative and quantitative methods. As the short commentary section only allows a maximum of 140 characters, the assumption here is that users are likely to comment on the most important aspect of the films to them. During the collection of data, the film's average rating was at 6.8, with 174,341 comments available for analysis. However, due to technical difficulties, only 2,315 comments were collected manually due to time constraints. So all the comments collected were put through NVivo, where a word frequency query was conducted to identify the most frequently used words. This slide displays the top 10 most frequently used words on Douban for the mermaid. The words and phrases include Stephen Chow, laugh, film, Zhang Yuqi, Deng Chao, protecting the environment, story, embarrassed or awkward, mermaid, and comedy. The film currently stands as the highest grossing film for any Hong Kong Chinese co-production, and I'll show you the first few minutes of the film to put everything in context, because most of the comments are actually about the first few minutes of the film. Okay, so based on the word frequency search, it seems that the comments show that Chinese audiences are still willing to spend money to watch Chow films due to his comedy track record as an actor and director in films such as Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle. So although the top 10 frequency used words and phrases show that majority of users find the film funny, many users also find the film to be embarrassing and awkward to watch. A user commented in 2016, just simply, "It's really embarrassing to watch." This comment garnered 3,067 votes, though there was no further elaboration as to why the film was embarrassing to watch, which meant a significant number of audiences felt the same way. So further investigation into the comments demonstrated two main issues with the film. First, the humor, which majority of the audiences found very nonsensical. And second, the chemistry between Deng Chao and Zhang Yuqi. A user commented, "After watching the film, I felt so embarrassed. There were a few laughing points, but what in the world is going on with the whole story and the actors?" Another user said, "Deng Chao and Zhang Yuqi are not able to communicate with each other through their acting. However, in other films, they show good chemistry with their co-stars. Just like this, the film becomes awkward." As Chao did not act in the film, many compared Deng's acting skills to Chao's signature style. 41% of the comments show negativity in Deng's acting, while 35% were positive and believed that his acting skills suited Chao's style. A user commented, "It's a pretty good film. Don't be put off by the vulgar trailer. The story is quite intact and is filmed in Stephen Chow's style. Deng Chao also used his own method to act out Stephen Chow's acting style, which did not feel out of place. Audiences were also quick to point out the outfits worn by Zhang and the sexual innuendos present throughout the film. As China does not have a rating system in place, the assumption is that all films are suitable for audiences of all ages. The mermaid display scenes showing Zhang's cleavage, which seems to have bypassed the censors, as camera angles used to shoot Zhang throughout the film also emphasize on the cleavage, as high-angle shots were frequently used when Zhang was seated. Shou Luo's octopus character also created an issue, as seen in the example on screen, as he attempts to wear a pair of pants using three of his tentacles. A user commented, "The 3D effects are probably used to show Zhang Yuqi's breasts and Shou Luo's tentacles." Ang Lee says Stephen Chow's films are made for children, but doesn't this seem like a spoof for Last Caution? Another said, "A lot of dirty dialogues and scenes, however, it's still funny." Nonetheless, 56% of all comments were positive. Overall, many users found the film funny and felt that the film was typical to Chow's signature style. A user commented and received 7,062 usefulness votes. "No one else can create films like Stephen Chow can. With much difficulty, I waited for this film to be released, so it should be treasured. Who else but Stephen Chow will be able to produce such a good film with an environmental theme?" So in summary, the comments show that although negative criticism of the film were specific, Chinese audiences still enjoy the film for its humor. Many users felt that the film was embarrassing and awkward to watch due to the type of humor being used and also the chemistry between the actors. The Mermaid also seemed to bypass several official regulations, which many users picked up on, especially with regards to Zhang's screen time. Nonetheless, star power played a huge role in enticing audiences to watch the film, as Chow films are much anticipated by Chinese audiences, while Deng Chao's popularity was at its peak in 2016. So this research demonstrates the richness of data received from audiences' comments and reviews placed on social networking sites. Examining audiences' opinions not only allow researchers to examine and evaluate the impact of strategies, but also to provide a greater story to specific findings examined in a film text, policy, and news analysis. This is important for co-productions, as industry players which I've interviewed do not believe that China has yet to achieve a successful co-production. Examining audiences' opinions will allow researchers to determine what strategies worked and what did not work in order to improve creative contributions in future productions. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the Q&A section of our evening now. So we have here Dr. Colin Shuer, who's a lecturer here at UNSW. His work here is mostly in media, teaching and thinking about media, but he's also worked in writing about Hong Kong cinema as well. So he will ask a few questions and then we'll open it up just you guys.
Thanks for the very generous intro, Mel. And thanks for the very interesting kind of talk as well, Kai. So we were just having a chat earlier about parts of what you were concerned about with your talk. I think there's a really strong original element to it in terms of what you're doing with regards to... Am I talking loud enough, guys?
Yeah.
It's been a long semester. So there's a really, I think, really interesting original angle to it in terms of what you're looking at, right? The kind of data you're getting, the user-generated content angle, that's really fresh in terms of Chinese cinema. You mentioned that you're really worried about the theoretical aspects of it. And I guess, looking and listening to your talk, some of the things I wanted to ask you about were with your definitions at the start. You're talking about audience, you're also talking about, you know, taste. Then you're starting to talk about social network sites. And I just wanted to ask you, with audience and with questions of taste, how are you drawing some of this together? Because what's interesting with social network sites is that you can start to really map patterns and sentiment in particular sorts of ways, and you can trace taste. And one of the interesting theoretical questions is, you know, what does taste do in terms of stabilizing, pulling together certain communities and audiences? And it's a very different audience now as compared to, say, the 60s and 80s when you look at traditional media studies. So when you pull some of this stuff together, you know, and you look at co-productions, which is fascinating because they're hybrid, because what happens with co-productions is there's this tension here between audiences. How would you describe some of the kind of primary theoretical questions that you're asking, you're starting to develop in your project? And how are these theoretical questions starting to guide the way you're working through your data, your interviews, and some of the stuff that you're looking at?
There's something that I was looking at that I do realize that was very helpful, which is the idea of cultural proximity. But that's only clear when I looked at productions between China and Hollywood, China and Australia, and less obvious in China, Korea, China and Hong Kong, yeah. Even though scholars have argued that there is a level of, cultural proximity doesn't really exist in those cases because a lot of scholars are very strongly against showing that they have similar cultural values as Chinese audiences. One thing I've also noticed that I have to take note as well is that many of the audiences on Douban have exposure to the West in the sense of cinema, television shows, or have traveled out of China. So their replies or their comments and reviews might not actually be what the mass audience is thinking of. So that's one thing that I have to take note of as well. So when I'm looking at audience taste, the idea of cultural imperialism actually strikes me because these people are so exposed to Western media and they're comparing to Chinese cinema. Are their opinions really valid? Because I made this comment because when I look through all my case studies, what I've realized is that they seem to lower their standards when they're looking at Chinese cinema.
Really?
So they will say, for example, if it's a movie like Monster Hunt, which had post-production by an ex-Hollywood guy, they will say, oh, for Chinese cinema, this is great. But otherwise, and then ...
Yeah.
So the idea here of audience taste is really interesting because they are actually putting forward and telling everyone that they're reducing, you know, their expectations because it's from China. And this is something I'm trying to explore. So I'm trying to explore that with the idea of cultural imperialism because they are so used to watching stuff in the West and how they are talking about Chinese cinema. Like, they have that sense of, like, oh, I'm China-ish, like, bad in comparison to the West. And I have to lower my standards when I'm watching this because it's not up to what I'm used to. That's what it seems like.
It's kind of funny because you cited Pierre Bourdieu's stuff as well. And, you know, cultural capital is obviously a thing because you're looking at these films, it's like, you know, what's a good film? What has distinction in that particular sort of way? But it's also fascinating because when you look at co-productions, right, there's a particular kind of political agenda and investment in there as well. It's strange, I got to confess, when I think about Chinese co-productions, the first film that pops into mind, this reveals my age, is the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, right? Which was a Hollywood and Shaw Brothers co-production. And people looked at it and thought, this is kind of good, bad but good at the same time. What's interesting now looking at these audiences is Chinese co-productions are a particular kind of commodity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're judging this commodity, you're not really judging the commodity, you're kind of judging yourself as well. Is that something you see when you listen to these producers, these directors, you say you've interviewed them? Is this something they're very aware of as they talk about it?
If you talk about the producers themselves, no. But if you talk about people who are working for these producers, yes. Because they, for example, there's this Korean film that I'm looking at, Chinese-Korean co-production called Mr. Go. And I have access to the production company that co-produced it with China. The person, the director and all that, they wouldn't think that because they were very adamant that their decision was right. But then when you talk to the people who are working below them who had to cope all the shit from left, like from China and Korea, yeah. They actually do think that.
It's hard, right, when you've got two bosses to answer to.
Yes, yeah. Because they'll be like, for example, in that film, baseball is a very popular sport in Korea, but in China, it's basketball. No one cares about baseball. No one plays baseball. You don't see it on TV. But in that film, baseball was the main sport. So the people working under the director was like, this is not going to work. And it didn't work. But the director wanted to keep a Korean element in it, so he kept it in. That's the problem with co-productions, that they have to try to fuse two different cultural aspects together because that is what they have to do on paper. So I went to the Australian-China co-production forum in Australia, in Sydney, and the vice president of the co-production, China Film Group co-production division came, and he actually said that it's a must that you have to show two different cultures in the co-production, which is a big problem, which producers are actually struggling to trying to maintain. Because that's why co-productions are not working, they believe, because they have to combine two cultures in one film, but they can't find the middle ground yet. So yeah, these are issues as well. But it depends on who you speak to.
Right. It's the success, but also the failure of globalization all at the same time.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the reason why your thesis is very brave, because what you have to do is you have to, you mentioned that what you want to do is look at the reception of the audience, but at the same time, what you're describing is that you can't get rid of the political and the economic angles. You have to still consider the economic imperatives. You still have to address the political kind of pressures. And then you have to look at the kind of cultural reception, but that can't be divorced from the other kind of top levels down. So when you look at the kind of cultural reception, you know, are you tying it into the kind of stuff that's imposing particular structures on it?
Yes, I am. But the biggest problem with this is that, so I, when I started my thesis, my idea was, oh, I'm going to listen to what the audience have to say. And then it could, you know, in the future be like, I don't know, I was just thinking too big. Like, be a handbook or something, you know, like, or a way to move forward. Like, what can we do? You know, what's the next steps you can do? But as I go into further into my research, I find that it's quite impossible to do that because the audiences have this mindset because, again, they are so used to consuming certain media products. And then you have these co-productions, which are like nearly like, I don't know, like a lot of movies are co-produced with China right now, a lot of Hollywood movies. And then so it's suddenly these type of films change their perception, but the audiences are not aware of the political side. So they realize there's a shift in content, but they don't understand why, which comes out with all these negative feedback. As a mass consumer myself, when I go watch a movie, I'm not going to think about the political aspects of the film. I'm just going to sit there and enjoy.
You're a film academic now.
I mean, let's say a mass audience, like they're not going to, they're not going to bother. And these are the people they are selling to. Like, and I think China is starting to see this as an issue, because if you look at Fast and Furious 7, it has Chinese investment in it. But there was no mention of China in the film. So I think China is slowly trying to shift away from what they're doing now, which is seen in The Mermaid and other case studies in my thesis as well. Or like Warcraft, even though it's a bad movie, there was no inclusion of China in the whole film, even though it's largely financed by China. And things like some of the Marvel movies as well was financed by the Chinese. But but Iron Man did show, for example, Iron Man did show scenes of China, but they removed it for the international release, but only included in the Chinese release. So like this progress actually shows you that the government is aware of this, but then it's really hard to like come up with a handbook or like, you know, how to move forward because the political and the creatives are always against each other. And the problem is that producers are aware of these issues, but they can't overcome it. Because if not, the film won't get released. Because the censorship restrictions are so big. Unless you're probably Stephen Chow or something, then maybe you can talk your way out of it. But that's why co-productions are so terrible. Terrible to watch now, in 2017. They still make money.
Yeah, they still make big money. In this.
Because they have money to invite top stars to act in the film. And star power, even in cinema, you know, 10 years ago, star power is what drives people to the cinema. Star power, be it the director or the main cast. Your movie could be really bad, but no one at the cinemas, no one really cares if the movie is bad because if you see, this is my favorite actor, and especially in China, people will just go watch. So even if people give bad reviews, they still make money. Like we were talking about Stephen Chow. Even though he's been making bad movies over the past few years, people still would go in hopes that, you know, it's something like what it was before. They'll still pay money to go see it, which is what the distributors want because they are thinking of, you know, profits. But I'm looking at a different angle where I'm thinking the audience will soon get tired of this, I guess, you know, especially with what's happening with technology, with the internet and everything, especially in China now, it's opening up more. Audiences will still soon get tired of this. It might not be next year, but eventually they will. And, you know, pirating is such a big issue in China too, so how are they going to stop
all this? Well, it seemed to be one of the key points of contribution for your thesis, right, in terms of looking at the changing audience in China and exactly how it's changing through new technologies. And I was wondering if you're looking at things like, you know, Jenkins talks about participatory culture. There's all these other kind of ways of thinking about it, like, you know, that word I hate, presumption, you know, different kinds of active audiences. Is that something you're kind of theoretically looking at, different audiences, how they're becoming more competent, they have more cultural capital, are able to judge things a little bit better?
Yep, I'm looking at that because the Douban audience actually is very helpful for that because they are seen, there's actually a term for them in Chinese because they are seen as above the masses, you know, because they are slightly more educated in cultural products. They read literature, you know, they can speak English, you know, there's actually a term for them. So yes, I'm actually looking at that as well. But the problem I have is there's a lot of assumptions to be made because I only can make the assumption through the demographics of Douban audience, not based on who the people I'm looking at. I don't know their demographics, but it's just based on the overall stuff. So,
but that's the whole point of consuming particular cinematic commodities, right? They use them to kind of imagine your own community. And as you said, it's kind of helpful that there are predefined demographic, because you get a sense of who they see themselves as. And I suppose that's where it kind of ties in.
Yeah, with Jenkins' work, yes.
Yeah, so where do you see the future of co-productions in China? It seems to be a question that you kind of want to ask, but you're kind of afraid of asking at the same time.
So my plan was to end the chapter with The Great Wall. Has anyone heard?
I'm going to try to forget I watched it. Yeah.
I haven't seen it. Actually, I personally haven't seen it. So I was really lucky because one of my primary school friends now works for Legendary. So I managed to interview her. And it was actually very interesting to hear the strategies that was being utilized in the film. Like, but I can't put in my thesis, but then it gave me the direction of where to look. And she said The Great Wall, and it was actually also released in the news, that was a strategy that failed and they're going to move on. So I think right now, because they have so much money, they have so much capital on their hands, they're just trying out different strategies and just like, okay, it doesn't work, next. So even before the film was released, because they do focus groups, right? They did a focus group in America and it just failed in the American focus group. So they've already moved on even before the film's released. So that's what the biggest problem I have with my thesis is, it becomes obsolete so quickly. Even with this case study, The Mermaid, in August, the film became obsolete because, you know, everything's just moved so quickly because they have the capital, like economic capital, to just like move on.
Well, depends what you want to pitch as the crux of your film, right? It's not. I would say that the crux of your thesis, or the crux of your thesis, is not. It's not really the films. It's thinking about how audiences have changed. It's thinking about how they can create new communities now through these social media sites, and that's not going to go out of date that quickly.
No, but because I want to do something from an industry perspective as well, and not just focus on theoretical, because it's hard to get a job in academia.
So you're writing the equivalent of co-production.
I'm writing in both angles, I guess, because I want to find a job.
Cultural proximity.
Yeah. I want to find a job somewhere.
It's almost kind of like translation, though. I mean, it's one of the key questions that used to be attached to Chinese cinema studies, right? The problem of translation and also the problem of, you know, different languages.
Yeah.
You're kind of culturally translating stories that don't really cross over very well, because you're trying to satisfy too many different people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's this massive bet that you can make because there's so much money involved.
Yeah.
And I'm really tempted to say that, you know, what's most fascinating about this is the kind of political angle, the socio-political kind of angle. Mm-hmm. Mel asked me to talk for 10 minutes. I think I've gone way over that, have I?
That's okay.
So I might just kind of open the floor up to questions now, because I think I've hogged enough questions.
Seems to me that there's a parallel between what you're talking about and what's happening in television, which I can't help draw because I'm a television studies person. But there is sort of this increasing thrust towards international co-productions, but they tend to be led by like quite sort of notable film or television creators, like. I'm thinking Jane Campion's Top of the Lake, which, you know, you throw a British woman, an American, an Australian, you know, and a New Zealand director in there.
It's a lot more freedom, though, in television co-productions at the moment.
Yeah, and like Brian Fuller's Hannibal, which is like a strange, like French-American co-production, all the Wachowski siblings, Sense8. There does seem to be this sort of enigmatic filmmaker, enigmatic auteur at the head of them. And that seems to be one way to go. And the other way to go with international co-production seems to be like almost like a removal of any kind of national identity, which is something like Orphan Black, I'm thinking, which is almost like placeless in many ways and has no national identity and is so international it loses its nationalness. And there does seem to be a question of national identity and national identity formation, and is national identity still as central to national cinemas as the Chinese government would like to believe it is? Because they seem to be desperately holding on.
It's not just the Chinese government, though. It's like with any international co-productions, because they are official documents. So it's like a treaty that's being signed. So it's usually signed with other treaties, including like something to do with the economy. America is the only country in the world that does not sign treaties for film, because it has its free trade agreement. So in the free trade agreement, film is actually in there. An example would be in Korea. So America's a free trade agreement with Korea, and in the free trade agreement, because Korea was like China previously, where there's a restriction on foreign film quota. So in the free trade agreement, they have to allow a certain number of Hollywood films into Korea. So America's the only one that doesn't have a treaty. But with other countries, for example, for Singapore and Australia, the treaty that was signed, the film co-production treaty was signed, is actually very political. There's a political agenda behind it. It's not really done to... I mean, yes, it's done to boost the national cinema of participating country, but it's also tied in with other political factors and economic factors. So, for example, with the Singapore... There's a Singapore-Australian co-production called Bait 3D, which is set in Gold Coast. And it's about a shark taking over a supermarket.
Yes. That sounds so good.
It's so good.
You've seen it?
It's so good.
You've seen it?
I love it so much.
So, this is a very interesting case study because first it's a Singapore Australia co-production, and then later on it got Chinese investment, so then they started putting Chinese elements in it. But because it's a Singapore-Australia co-production, and Australia financed most of the film, only two of the main characters are Singaporean. Well, one's a permanent resident, one's a Singaporean, and the whole film was set in Australia.
And so, wasn't it like the height? It was like something absurd.
But
really?
Really?
Like, it made no money in Australia, but it made a huge amount of money
in China. Yes, it made about $24 million in China. It's my honest thesis, but the budget was only $20 million, so it actually made a $5 million profit. But there was actually a lot of things that happened.
We might have to go back and rewatch this.
It's amazing. It's got like Xavier Samuels in it.
Yeah, the guy from Twilight.
I think the point you make is valid, though. I mean, national identity is something that's inextricable, right? But also the questions of prestige and distinction. And it's so deeply bound. That's what's distinctive about studying Chinese co-productions, because ideologically, that's still the main angle that they're going to, right?
But it's the same with any other country, too. So Australian co-productions with other countries that have signed the treaty with... that both countries have signed a treaty, not by companies, but by the governments... They try to retain the national identity of the film, of each country. And this is actually based on the financial contribution. So if let's say I finance 60%, if I'm from Singapore, I finance 60% of the film, there needs to be 60% of Singaporeanness. So there's actually a checklist, right? So in Australia, at least, there's a checklist. In China, it depends on the mood of the censors. So in different countries, there's many different procedures, but in each treaty that I've examined, the legal documents, they actually do state that national identity is a must. So that could be done by a filming location or the language that's being used in the production. So these are actually like big issues that is different from television.
Yeah, and television has such a long history of co-productions, especially like Australian television industry doesn't exist unless they can get co-produced from the UK.
But the thing is like with television...
I'm supposed to say that in public, Jessica.
But television co-productions are mainly done as co-productions between companies rather than between governments, whereas for cinema, it's between governments, which is why national identity actually plays a role in the films that are being released.
So I'm going to pick your brain afterwards because I just submitted my Bonnie's proposal thing, which is all about alternate versions of films made for other countries. So picking up almost... Very specifically on the point you made about the Iron Man example of specific scenes shot for China that weren't in the US and other countries' versions, and that that's becoming increasingly, or actually, the more I look at it, there's lots of historical examples of doing that, but technology is making that easier to do because it's pretty easy to...
insert scenes.
Yeah, exactly, and to distribute them as well. You know, you don't have the same problem with reels of film. But in particular, I'm interested in terms of, with Jess's point about national identity and the way that, it's funny that you use the word handbook because I think from certain production perspectives, there is an argument that is made that you can tick off, whether it's agreed with or not, you can actually tick off the criteria for that 16%. At a certain point, that there is a logic that if we just chuck these Chinese actors in for this scene, to make this point, that is meeting our quota, and that it won't, it's not a part of the film that needs to be seen anywhere else, is I think really fascinating. I'm going to ask you more about it afterwards, but I just zeroing in on that, like where you diverge from the cultural co-production to the alternate version stuff, where you actually just making specific versions of it that that can travel without having to be tempered with or being tempered.
Yeah. Actually, this was one of my focus on the thesis, but I have to take it out because the Chinese government actually came up with a new regulation that you cannot do that anymore.
Right.
So if you were to talk about something like that, it will be historical.
Right.
Because now the version that you show in China has to be the same version you show everywhere else in the world. So technically it gives the Chinese government the power to say whether your film can be distributed internationally. Because if, let's say, you want to have a market in, if you want to show your film in the Chinese market, if the Chinese government say no, you can't release it elsewhere, because if you release it elsewhere, you can never release it back in China. So it becomes, it becomes a historical thing. But in the past, that was what it was, because especially with Hollywood films, with Looper, Iron Man, and all that, X-Men as well, they showed alternative versions in China, because the Hollywood producers at that time was like, we don't think this will work for international audiences. We're going to get criticized, so we decided not to show this version. And at that time, China was just starting, you know, to step their foot into Hollywood. But now, if you look at the political and economic side of it, more and more Chinese companies are buying out or investing in big Hollywood companies. So that gives them more power to actually dictate what's in the film. So now, I don't think there's any alternate versions anymore if you look at films released this year.
They still have, for Hollywood films, like, they still have no issue with Hollywood films doing a China-only edit for the release. Like, the government are not opposed to that. The film gets changed just for the Chinese audience.
They can't do that anymore.
Oh, you can't do it.
You can't do that anymore.
Hollywood movies.
Only it has for co-productions, though.
No, for Hollywood, for
even
foreign,
for
import
as well.
Films as well.
Wow. Did they change that last year?
Recently, this year, I think.
Okay.
This year or late last year. It's very, very recent.
Yeah.
So the thing is with, that's where it becomes a gray area, because now most Hollywood films that are in China are not under the foreign film quota anymore.
Yeah.
They're under joint production. Because there's a joint production is you need a foreign and local investment. So Chinese companies like Huawei Brothers or even the China Film Group are investing in these Hollywood productions. So then they can apply for joint production status and then they'll get domestic status. So, but for domestic status, you can't show other versions. And Hollywood films would rather get domestic status or joint production status because it means they don't have to fight for, there are only 34 films allowed, foreign films allowed in China. So then they don't have to fight for that quota.
Yeah,
so landscapes change. Are you talking about this in your thesis?
Yeah, so it'll be in the completion chapter because it just happened. It literally just happened. So the things change very quickly.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.